thanks very much, Benny. And yeah, thanks for inviting me to come speak here. Yeah, I did my undergrad at the University of Waterloo, but then somehow never actually came inside this building, so it's good to be here. And yeah, today I'm very happy to tell you about how we might do error correction with quantum LDPC codes, and in particular, my work on decoding them. And so, yeah, before I get started, let me thank my collaborators on these two papers, which are the projects that I'll be talking about today. Right, so the main problem of quantum error correction is that our physical devices are, in general, noisy. And so if we want to do like a very large-scale quantum computation, then we're going to need some form of error correction to reduce the error rate. And yeah, so we don't expect to be able to like reduce the error rate just by improving our experiments. And so we have this technique of encoding the information in some larger Hilbert space so that if errors occur, then we can actually detect the errors and correct them. But because we're doing some redundant encoding, then there's going to be overheads involved. And in particular, there's the space overhead, which is how many extra qubits do you need to implement this error correction scheme. And you know, that will be determined by the encoding rate of the code, but also the distance of the code. Because if you have a good family of codes with a distance scaling well, then you don't have to go to as large code sizes in order to achieve the same error suppression. And of course, we should also count the number of ancilla qubits as part of this space overhead. There's another type of overhead, which is the time overhead involved in doing error correction. And that's because it might take longer to do an operation at the logical level compared to if you were just to do it on like physical qubits. Another thing that could play into the time overhead is actually what decoding algorithm you use, because you're running this classical algorithm in between every error correction round, so that will eat into your time overhead. And additionally, depending on how good the decoder is, like you might have to actually run like multiple rounds of error correction and decoding cycles between every single logical operation that you do. So there's a space overhead and time overhead, and the main question that I want to be addressing in this talk is how can we do fault-tolerant quantum computation with the lowest possible overhead, so lowest possible space and lowest possible time overhead. And the outline for my talk is that first I'll give some background on quantum LDPC codes, and in particular, say how we can actually achieve constant space overhead using quantum LDPC codes. And then in the next portion, I'll talk about this time overhead of error correction. And this will relate more to my work on decoders. So I'll give a provably correct decoder for a family of quantum LDPC codes, which have good parameters. And then next, I'll also talk about the single-shot decoding problem, which is how we might deal with measurement noise. As well. And then finally, I'll give some remarks on what are the next steps in quantum LDPC codes. So before I get started, are there any questions? Also, feel free to interrupt me anytime for questions. So. Yeah. OK, good. Then let's get started. So let's start off with a very easy example, which is the surface code. And you know how this code is defined is that we have some two-dimensional lattice. And then we place the qubits on the edges of this lattice. And then we can put stabilizer checks on the vertices and the plaquettes of the lattice. Right? So for every vertex, we have a four-body z check on the qubits around this vertex. And then for every plaquette, we have a four-body x check around that plaquette. And then because all of these checks commute with each other, then we can define the code space as a simultaneous plus one eigenspace of all of these operators. And so this defines the toric code or surface code. And actually, this right now is the leading candidate for practical implementation of quantum LDPC codes, or I guess practical implementation of quantum error correcting codes, which, I mean, this is an LDPC code. And the reason why everyone likes the surface code so much is that it has a lot of advantages. And one of the main ones is that it has geometrically local stabilizer checks. So if we place the qubits on some two-dimensional lattice, as was described, then all of the stabilizers are affecting qubits in some local region. And for many architectures, that's really important, like superconducting architectures, where you can't really move around the qubits and all of the interactions are actually local. And additionally, like this Tor code has been around for a very long time, for like 25 years. So a lot of research has been done on it, and we know exactly how to implement this code, how to decode this code. Like there are many different types of decoders, and we know how to perform logic using like lattice surgery, magic state distillation, et cetera. And so that's why it's the leading candidate right now. But the main downside of the code, in my opinion, is that it actually has very poor code parameters. So what do I mean by this? Well, if you have any error correcting code, then you can have you can define these parameters that kind of tell you how good this code is. And the first parameter is this code length n, which is the number of physical qubits involved in the code. Then there's the dimension k, which is the number of encoded logical qubits. And we also have the distance d, which is the weight of the smallest non-trivial logical operator. And in particular, if you have a distance d code, then it can correct any error affecting less than qubits, like less than half the distance. And so if we try to find these parameters for the surface code, then we find, if you have like a L by L grid, then it's going to have L squared qubits. It's only encoding one logical qubit, and the distance is going to be L because the non-trivial logical operators are running across this lattice. So the scaling is that we only have a constant dimension, and the distance is scaling as the square root of the number of qubits. So it's not super good, and that will result in actually high overhead if you want to do quantum error correction using the surface code. Like for some estimates, like if you wanted to run some large-scale algorithms, you might need to have 100 or 1,000 physical qubits per logical qubits. So that's really going to be high overhead. But then we can ask, like, can we do better than the surface code? And if we want to keep all of the benefits of the surface code, then the answer is actually no, because we have this Bravi-Poulenter-Hall bound, which states that if you require this geometric locality condition, then in two dimensions, the code parameters have to satisfy k times d squared equals order n. And if we plug in the values for the surface code, then it's already saturating this bound. So that's kind of the best that we can do if we have this additional restriction. And so if we want to do better, then maybe one thing we can do is actually relax the condition on geometric locality. And if you do that, then we can obtain this larger class of codes called low-density parity check codes. And for these codes, the only condition is that the stabilizers have to be constant weight. So not necessarily like in some geometrically local region, but just touching like a constant number of qubits. And the reason that we still want this constant weight condition is that these lower weight checks are going to be easier to measure than if you want to do like a measurement that involves every qubit in your system. So it'll be easier to implement. And also it's important for fault tolerance purposes because like during the process of measuring this check, it's possible that an error on one of these qubits could spread to like all of the other qubits involved in that check. So you don't want like one error to spread to many other errors, and then that wouldn't be fault tolerant. Okay, so now that we defined this larger class of codes, then we can ask the same question again, like what are the best possible parameters for LDPC codes? And this is a question that has quite a history and was only answered recently, actually. So let me go over some of that, the major developments for quantum LDPC codes, because I think it's pretty interesting. So the first LDPC code family was, we could say that it's actually the surface code. And it has this additional feature of having geometrically local checks. And again, it doesn't have super great parameters. And one of the next major developments came in the form of these hypergraph product codes. And the way that this works is that you can take any two classical codes and then combine them in a way to get a quantum code. And because like people have studied classical codes a lot, and we actually know like many good constructions of classical codes, so if you input some classical codes with good parameters, then the resulting quantum codes will actually get like the distance scaling still as a square root, so similar to the surface code, but now the encoding rate is constant. So that is performing significantly better than the surface code already. And for this hypergraph product construction, it's kind of based on some tools in algebraic topology, like these chain complexes and homology groups. And so after this construction, like, people try to continue using this language to develop quantum codes. And Ha Hastings and O'Donnell were able to come up with these fiber bundle codes, which is kind of having some twist in this homological product. And they were able to get some better parameters in this way. And they actually broke this square root n distance barrier. So for a while, like, people weren't sure if, like, this square root of n distance was actually some fundamental thing for quantum codes. But then after this, then I guess we knew that it wasn't. And you know, using the similar kind of language, that we were able to construct these lifted product codes and balanced product codes, which, you know, got even better parameters. Until in late 2021, Pantaleev and Kalachev were able to prove that these expander lifted product codes can actually attain these so-called asymptotically good parameters. So what that means is that now we see that the dimension and distance are both scaling linearly with the code length. So that's really the best that you can hope for any code. And shortly after this proof, there were these other kind of variations of this construction in the form of quantum Tanner codes and also these DHLV codes that were also able to achieve similar parameter scaling. And I guess for this talk, I'll mostly be focusing on quantum Tanner codes because these codes are a bit easier to analyze. Okay, so yeah, any questions about this so far?
Is DHLV better than quantum Tanner code in some sense? Because it put it at the bottom.
Oh, I guess this is just in chronological order of Yeah, I mean, they all obtain the similar parameter scaling. I mean, I guess you can compare, like, if the constants are better for one versus the other.
Right.
But I think this is not really, I guess that was not really the main focus of these constructions. Yeah. I mean, I think all of the constants for these asymptotically good codes are quite bad. Yeah.
Is there some logical upper bound that, like, because it looks like n, and you said also, like, something like this? Is there, like, some logical upper bound you cannot be better than this? Or?
Well, I guess because n is the number of physical qubits, so
okay.
You cannot get better than scaling with n. But I guess you can talk about, like, can you get, like, a better constants for these?
Okay, but I'm actually, like, asymptotically.
Yeah, asymptotically, like this is the best that you can do. And so that's why I say, like, you know, this question was only answered, like, 2 years ago by Pantaleev and Kalachev. Like, this, you can actually achieve this kind of trivial upper bound. Yeah. Okay, so then we can ask, like, you know, what does having all of these good parameters buy us? And there's this very nice result by Gottesman in 2014 saying that if you have an LDPC codes with these parameters that, like, you know, you have constant encoding rate and the distance scaling, I mean, not even necessarily, like, linearly with the code length, but even polynomially is okay. Like, if you have such a code, then you can actually achieve a quantum error correction with constant space overhead. And I guess to prove this result, like, you need a few assumptions. And one of them is that, of course, you need long-range interactions because we know that we can't do it with local interactions. And another one is that you kind of need an efficient decoder if you don't assume that this classical computation is free. So let me say a bit about, you know, this long-range interaction stuff. And then for the rest of my talk, I'll be talking about the decoder. And so we can ask, like, okay, like, what if you have an architecture that actually is only, like, geometrically local, only has geometrically local interactions, like superconducting qubits? Then, like, can you still make use of LDPC codes? And there's this proposal by Patterson, Krishna, and Preskill, which says that actually you can still do it. So you just have your LDPC code, and then what you can do is concatenate the with a surface code. So for every physical qubit in your LDPC code, like, you replace it with a small surface code patch, like, let's say of a logarithmic size, and that will actually buy you enough protection that you can implement these measurements, even the non-local ones, by just doing swap operations between the different surface code patches. Okay, so that's kind of the worst case scenario that you can do this. Then we can have, like, an optimistic scenario where you do have all-to-all connectivity. And then for that, maybe you can consider, like, neutral atoms where you can just physically move around the qubits. And based on these neutral atoms, like, there are some proposals for LDPC codes by this Harvard group, also this group in Chicago. And there, like, they they implement these hypergraph product codes, also lifted product codes, and they give like exactly what is the schedule for moving these qubits around to achieve the syndrome measurements. And then we can also consider some intermediate regime where, let's say, like most of your interactions are local, but you can have a few long-range interactions. All right, then this is work by a group at IBM saying that like exactly how to implement these bivariate bicycle codes. And for that, like you can just arrange it in some square lattice like this. But for each qubit, you also enhance it with two long-range interactions. And it also has some translation symmetry. And basically there, they do some simulations on this code, and you actually get some pretty reasonable threshold numbers if you can have an architecture like this. And so I guess the reason that I show you all of this slide is just to say that actually, like LDPC code is not just some like theoretical calculations, but like it actually has some chance of being implemented in practice. Okay, so that's kind of what I wanted to say about like this space overhead. Like, any questions before I go on to decoders?
So when you say LDPC code is not geometrically local, dimensional manifold, are you thinking just for 2D or
actually any dimension? So you cannot implement it in any like Euclidean space. Okay, so now let's get into like decoders for LDPC codes. And so the interesting thing is that like if you have an error correcting code, that doesn't actually tell you how to correct errors, because like the error correcting code is just some static subspace of a Hilbert space, and you know if you go out of that subspace, you still need a way to get back into it. And so this is the decoding problem where some unknown error, let's say some Pauli error, is applied to your code state, and what you can do is measure these stabilizers, and that will tell you which stabilizers anti-commutes with the error that occurred. Right, so this will give you a syndrome, which you can think of as just some classical bit string sigma. And then what you want to do is input this bit string into a classical decoding algorithm. And that decoding algorithm should give you some candidate correction to apply to your code state, let's say f hat. And so we say that the decoder succeeds if e plus f hat takes you back into the original state that you started with. So it doesn't have to be the identity operator, but it could just be any stabilizer, because stabilizers act trivially on your code space. Okay, and why is it important to have a good decoder? Well, I mean, it's a classical algorithm that you're running in between every round of error correction. So that's not going to be like free. And in particular, you have to be able to decode faster than errors actually accumulate on your device, or else you end up with this like backlog problem where you know some errors occur and you're trying to decode it, but during the process of trying to decode it, like more errors accumulate, and then you just get like larger and larger errors. So we don't want that. And also, like you cannot leave all of the decoding until the end of the algorithm, because for implementing certain gates, you actually need to know like which poly frame you're in, and so you cannot like just leave it until the end. So actually, like the problem of decoding in general is quite difficult. It's actually like NP complete or SHARP complete, depending on which setting you're considering. So we don't expect to be able to solve this problem for like an arbitrary stabilizer code. But we do know that many efficient decoders do exist for like specific code families. And the reason for that is that like the codes that we're considering are not just some random codes, like they're constructed in some particular way to have particular properties, and we can also use those additional structures to find efficient decoders for these codes. And of course, like if we want to implement the code in practice, then we're gonna have to have an efficient decoder. So at the time that these asymptotically good LDPC codes were discovered, like it wasn't known whether they could be decoded efficiently. So I guess like technically it's possible that like asymptotically good parameters like not compatible with efficient decodability. Although I don't think anyone really thought that. But I guess that's the subject of our work, which is to try to find these efficient decoders. And for the problem of decoding, we can also consider two different settings. And the first one is the case of adversarial noise. And in this setting, we want to be able to decode any error of sufficiently small weight. And so that error can be chosen adversarially. And we want to decode, let's say, any error of weight up to some fraction of the distance. But we can also consider maybe a more realistic scenario of stochastic noise. And the, in the case of stochastic noise, you have some random model for how errors occur on your device. And we just want to be able to decode the error with high probability. So in general, like these two settings are not comparable with each other. Because like if you have a decoder that can correct stochastic noise, then it doesn't have to correct every single possible error, like just correcting with high probability. And if you have one that only decodes in the adversarial case, then like maybe you cannot actually decode errors of very high weight. That like you know like the errors that would be typical for stochastic noise. But then in the scenario where you have a linear distance code as we're dealing with, then actually like if you can correct in the adversarial case, it will automatically imply the ability to correct in the stochastic setting because of this linear distance. Like then like any stochastic noise will be less than that distance with good probability. Okay, so I guess that's the stuff about like decoders in general. And now let me start getting into like the actual code that we're dealing with. And these are these quantum Tanner codes. So quantum Tanner codes were invented by Le Verrier and Zamor. And the way that it works is it's based on this left-right Cayley complex, which you can think of just as some two-dimensional like object, but it's like a very expanding object. So this object has vertices, edges, and faces, and the faces are squares. So what we do is we place the qubits on the squares of this the complex, and then the checks are going to be associated with the vertices of the complex. So in particular, the vertices are split into into this bipartition Vx and Vz. And we place some x checks on every x-type vertex, and we place the z checks on every z-type vertex. So what I mean by that is like, let's say this black dot represents a z-type vertex. Then there's going to be a few stabilizer checks associated with this vertex. And for each of these checks, it's going to be touching like a subset of the qubits on these faces. Okay, so I didn't specify exactly how this process works, but it's going to be determined by some like classical code that should be chosen appropriately. But like the important thing is that it's just that like there's some set of z-type checks associated with this vertex. And like why does this construction give a code with good distance? Well, okay, so remember that the distance is the weight of the smallest non-trivial logical operator. And so let's consider such an operator L. Then we can imagine like what L looks like. So we can consider like if it has some non-trivial support around a given let's say z-type vertex, then like because of the checks around this vertex, it's going to require that L has like a large support around the vertex. So that's like if you choose the local codes correctly. And so let's say like these green qubits are in the support of L. Then, I mean, we can do this process again. So we can look at like this other z-type vertex here, and again say that like L has to have a large support around this vertex. So let's say now like these three qubits are in the support. And we can kind of just keep doing this process over and over again and saying that around every single vertex, it has to have a high weight. And what happens is that like because this object is very expanding, like the process can't really close in on itself until you have very high support already. So like you can only satisfy all of the checks making it a logical operator if like the weight of L is actually like linear in N. So that's kind of like very rough intuition on why this code has good distance. And I guess the encoding rate is much easier to prove. Like once you have the specific description of the code, like you just count the number of stabilizers that you have, and then you find the dimension of the code. But yeah, the main part is how do you show this distance? But using this intuition for why the code has good distance, we can also design a decoder for it. And the reasoning is this. So now let's say that we have some x-type error e, and let's say that it actually has low weight. Okay, so now I kind of drew the same configuration on the support, but now let's imagine that the error is in just in this finite region, so it doesn't go on through the whole complex. And so E is really a low weight error. Then, like, what can happen is that E can satisfy all of the checks, like, let's say, in this interior of this error region. Because, like, if we see around all of these vertices, like, it has high weight, so maybe it can actually satisfy all the checks on those vertices, and you actually cannot detect the presence of E on those vertices. But then if we look at, like, the boundary of this error region, then we're going to see that, like, there's going to be a lot of unhappy checks. And the reasoning is that, like, for these vertices, like, the only support of the error is just this qubit here, so like it's not going to satisfy the checks because it has a low weight. Then, so for all of these points in the boundary, like, we're going to detect the error. So all of these stabilizers are unhappy. And what we can imagine doing is that, like, maybe we should actually be flipping some qubits around this boundary region, which will then result in more satisfied checks than before we did the flips. Right? So we just imagine doing flips around this boundary region. And we imagine just kind of iterating this process where we're trying to satisfy more and more checks, and that will result in kind of flipping the qubits around the boundary, and then we'll just shrink this error region until we correct all of the errors. Okay, so that's the intuition for how this decoder works. But I mean, in practice, like here, we actually see what the error region is, right? But the decoder doesn't actually see the error region. So let me try to formalize what I just said. So what we do is, you know, we have this X error that occurred. And then for every Z-type vertex, we can determine a candidate correction on the qubits in its neighborhood. So we let epsilon V be some correction that we could imagine applying. And if we apply epsilon V, then we would satisfy all the checks in this vertex. And we choose epsilon V of the lowest weight that would allow for this. So in the next step, we compute a potential function. And for this potential function, like, all we do is sum up the weights of all of the epsilon v's. So we can imagine, like, you know, maybe this is epsilon v for this vertex here, and maybe this is epsilon v for this other vertex here. You know, then we would just say that, okay, maybe this potential function is weight 4 now because we count the middle qubit twice.
So it's 2 plus 1 plus
8. This potential function. You just try to find some correction. Like, it just has to satisfy the checks on that particular vertex, not necessarily caring about other vertices. So it's basically like some local process that you can do. And, okay, so we compute this potential function, which is the sum of all these local corrections. And in the main part of the algorithm, what we're going to do is just look inside certain local regions and try to flip some qubits in order to decrease this potential. So by flip qubits, I mean, like, we imagine some X error has occurred, so we just imagine what happens if we apply some X corrections on certain qubits, and we try to do it so that we decrease this potential function. Yeah.
Why is this epsilon V called a correction? Like, what characterizes it to be a correction in this case?
Yeah, so I say correction because, like, there's going to be a bunch of checks associated with a given vertex.
Mm-hmm.
And if we if we apply epsilon V, we would actually satisfy all the checks, like, on that vertex. So it's kind of like a correction for this local set of checks.
Okay. Yeah. So this is something like you could measure and.
Yeah, you can just compute it. Like, based on the syndrome of this
okay.
Check, you can compute this epsilon v.
Okay.
So I guess also when I say, like, flip these qubits, we can also just imagine doing it. Like, we don't have to physically go and correct it right away.
Right.
But you can just compute what would the resulting potential be if you had applied that correction.
Okay,
so this is like an iterative decoder. Like, at every step, we just apply, we try to flip qubits in order to decrease this potential function.
I completely forgot So we compute the potential function, and then what do we do?
Right. So we can imagine, like, let's say what happens if we flip this middle qubit, right? So this qubit is part of the correction for this vertex and also for this vertex, right? So if we had flipped this qubit, then it would actually help satisfy those vertices.
Oh, okay. So for every qubit we ask, reduce the potential function?
Yeah. So you can imagine like asking every single qubit, but in fact, it's not enough to just flip single qubits. Like sometimes flipping individual qubits will not be able to actually decrease the potential.
In
some small local region. So in constant size regions, you can ask like, can you flip some subset of the qubit there? Right. So this is the main part of the algorithm. We do this iterative process, and we repeat this process until this potential reaches zero. And when the potential reaches zero, that means that like all of the vertices are happy because like there's no local correction.
Yeah. Why didn't the flip fix the other errors, like the other things in the light red, like shaded red?
Right. So I guess when I have this this kind of notation, it means that like these two would like only if you flip these two regions, then it would satisfy this stabilizer.
So you
would have to flip both, and that would result in I guess the norm of this epsilon v would be 2. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Good. So we do this process until u reaches zero, and then we see that when u reaches zero, it means all of the epsilon v's are zero. So none of the vertices want to make any more corrections. In other words, you satisfied all of the checks. So you're back in the code space. Okay. And then the main theorem that we prove.
What was it? So is it the correction operator?
Yeah, epsilon v would be the candidate correct, like the correction that you would want to apply.
So if stabilizers are zeta, it's just a bunch of x operators? Or?
Yeah, it would be some x. Like, I guess it would just be like these light red regions here.
Okay.
Right. So what we can prove about this decoder that I kind of went in rough terms is that we have a family of quantum Tanner codes with these asymptotically good parameters, such that if the initial error was sufficiently small weight, so less than some constant p star times the code length, then actually we can correct that error. And in addition, like the time complexity of this algorithm is linear, so it's an efficient decoder. Okay, so now let me remark that actually this decoder is the first one that can correct adversarial errors of up to linear weight. And the reason for this is that, like before, we just didn't have any linear distance codes. So, like, if you have a decoder that can correct adversarial errors, then the most it can correct is like half the distance. Okay. So actually, the previous best decoder for adversarial errors was this one by Evra, Kaufman, and Zamor. And of course, they were working with a different code, but that decoder can correct up to like square root of n log n. Okay. And the kind of the way that we prove that this decoder is correct is the main part is kind of like what I described to you in this intuition is that actually for sufficiently small errors that we can actually find a correction so this decoder doesn't get stuck at any point. That's the most challenging part of the proof. And once you can show that, then basically it remains to show that like once you get back into the code space that you actually get a state that's equivalent to the original one that you started with, right? So this is much easier to prove, and it will hold if the error is sufficiently small. Okay. And for the runtime of the algorithm, like we're saying, it's linear, and the reason is that like there's two steps, like the initialization step and the update steps. So when we initialize the decoder, like what we're trying to do is compute the potential function u. And to compute the potential function, we're evaluating a bunch of these local corrections epsilon v. And each epsilon v takes a constant amount of time to compute. And there's order n of them. So this initialization step takes time order n. And also in the update step, like we can note that there's at most order n iterations of updates. The reason being that like u is a integer valued function, and every time we're decreasing u by at least one. And so there's at most a linear number of iterations. And in every iteration, we're also just doing a constant correction, like correcting a constant region. So that takes a constant amount of time to update. Right. So that kind of is the outline for this proof. And yeah, are there any questions about this? Yeah.
So like for every code, is it possible to always find like a correction such that the potential function u equals to zero?
Right. So we show that in this first step.
yeah, kind of answered that.
Right, so it relies on some like properties of the code, in particular this expansion property of the complex. So it kind of related to the intuition that we can, you know, decrease this boundary bit by bit until we get to zero, like correct all the errors.
So the time complexity that you prove is like the algorithmic view to correct your error, kind of like the decoding, like what you mentioned, proving is like here then. Error correction procedure, kind of.
Yeah. So this time complexity is for the classical algorithm that run this decoder.
Yes. So like to algorithmically pick out like what kind of errors correction steps you need to perform. Like,
right. Right.
So you had like these two. One of them was the time complexity in your result, and the other one was what was the other one?
Space.
So like the number of qubits you have to correct or. It's like in space,
So I guess after you run this decoder, it will tell you what is the correction you need to apply for this whole, you know, on this whole code. For the space overhead, that's more what I was saying near the in the beginning of the presentation, and that doesn't necessarily have to do with the decoder. It's just how many extra qubits are you using compared to the logical qubits.
Okay.
So I guess I wasn't sure what exactly your question.
This P star, this upper bound P star n that you had,
I see.
This one, yes.
Right. So P star, you can think of it as some threshold. If your errors is below this weight P star times n, then this decoder will work.
So it's just the usual the previous distance, right?
It's not exactly the distance because. For this decoder, we can't correct up to distance over 2. It will be some smaller constant times the distance. Yeah.
So this this P star.
Yeah, it's just going to be some constant. Because we think there's a family of these quantum Tanner codes, so, and this will be constant for that entire family. Yeah.
Does this work for surface code?
This will not work for the surface code.
What is the extra property expanding?
Yeah, you really need this expanding property because if we look at surface code, right, you can have a long error string with only two syndromes at the end. So if you just look around the syndrome, there's nothing that you can do to really reduce this syndrome.
So another question is this decoder looks very local.
Right.
Is it local?
Yeah, it is a local decoder.
Local regions,
right.
Do optimization locally, and then try to...
Yeah. So that's really a property of the decoder that only occurs when you have an expanding complex.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Uh-huh.
So do you construct an actual family of Tanner graphs, where you not just asymptotically, you can correct up to... linear n errors, but I'm before asymptotically at every step you can correct with a constant
So this constant I guess will exist for the finite, whichever quantum Tanner. So you construct this family of growing sizes, right?
Okay.
So at any point it will correct this P star times n, but maybe for the small sizes it will not it will not be very good because this P star might be very small.
Can I ask a question? So do we need to worry about measurement error for the decoder?
Yeah.
I mean, like, if the checks give you wrong answers, so does this decoder still works?
Yeah, it will still work, which is kind of like the second part of this this decoder stuff. Yeah. That's a good question. But yeah, I guess I'll have the entire second half of the presentation to talk about that. Right. So, okay. I guess yeah. Let me just say that. So kind of all the result that I talked about here was really dealing with the adversarial setting, right? Because we're saying, like, you know, we're correcting all errors of sufficiently small weight, and now we can also consider what happens when there's stochastic noise. So let's say for simplicity it's just some IID modeled errors, which occurs with probability less than this P star, then we'll be able to succeed with probability exponentially close to one. And it's basically like a two-line reasoning for this, is that by the adversarial case, we succeed if it's less than P star times N, but it's very unlikely for us to be like greater than P star times N. We just use some tail bound for this binomial distribution. Okay. Yeah, let me skip this part on soundness. We just relate to some complexity theory things. And let's talk more about this single-shot decoding. And right, so this is the setting that you were asking, Cece, about what happens when the syndrome is possibly corrupted. And like, I mean, this is very relevant because when you actually go and measure the syndromes, like it could fail, right? And you get the wrong measurement result. So the result that I was presenting before, like, assumed that you actually have the correct syndrome information. And if your decoder has to have the correct syndrome information, then like it's not the end of the world. Like, there are some standard procedures that can deal with that. Like, what you can do is just repeat measurement rounds. So, you know, one measurement might be incorrect, so just repeat it many times, and then you'll have a more reliable measurement. But then that will incur some large time overhead, because you actually need to repeat like d times or even d squared times to obtain the same guarantees. Another way that you could do it is proposed by Steen, where you prepare a more complicated ancilla state offline, and you use that ancilla state to do the measurement, which is going to be more robust to errors. So this is good that you can do it with no time overhead, but then it will have a large space overhead, because you need to prepare this complicated ancilla state. And so, you know, when you run into this large overhead, then, for example, like when we compare a quantum algorithm with a classical algorithm for solving the same task, then, you know, we should consider all of this overhead involved. And another problem is that the one I mentioned before, where you have to decode faster than errors accumulate on your device. But like, there's another way to deal with this measurement error problem, and that was proposed by Bondman, where he called it like single-shot quantum error correction. And the way that this works is, like, sometimes the decoding problem has a lot of structure, and so like you can actually make progress in decoding even with the noisy syndrome information. So what that means is that the decoder will output some correction that like doesn't necessarily take you back exactly into the code space, but it could leave some very small residual error that is very manageable. Okay, so again, for a single-shot error correction, we can consider the adversarial or the stochastic scenario, and again, like, they're not really comparable with each other unless you have a linear distance code, in which case the adversarial case will imply the stochastic case. Okay, so for single-shot decoders, like, we do know many single-shot decoders that exist, and you know, one family of them is these topological codes. So we know that for 4D toric code, 3D subsystem toric code, and 3D gauge color code, we do have like single-shot decoders. And the reasoning is that like there's some redundancies in the check operators. So like, for example, this 3D subsystem toric code, the syndrome information can be thought of as these strings that in the absence of measurement errors should form closed loops. So if you find that they don't form closed loops, then you know that something has gone wrong, and then you can try to like make the correction accordingly. Another code that has the single-shot property is these quantum expander codes. proven by Fauzi, Grospellier, and Leverrier. So there, like the single shot property is not from like any kind of redundancies in the checks, but it's more because of this expansion property of the underlying complex. And this is also kind of the reasoning that we use for analyzing quantum Tanner codes. And finally, let me mention one result on like by Campbell that states that actually any stabilizer code can be made into a single shot code. And the way that this works is that like instead of measuring the original stabilizer generators, you can find some other set of stabilizer generators to measure that is more like robust to errors. And in general, like the set of stabilizer generators that you measure is going to be like some products of the original stabilizers. But then the problem here is that like if you start with an LDPC code, like it may not keep this low weight property because you're measuring you're multiplying a lot of the stabilizers together. Then you have a high weight operator that you need to measure. Okay, so here let me present like the definition of single shot that we actually use. So it's kind of the setup is kind of what you might expect is that we have this noisy syndrome sigma tilde which includes like this data error E, but also some syndrome error D. And we want to output a correction F hat. And so we say that the decoder is alpha beta single shot if for sufficiently low weight errors, like the residual error satisfies this property. So the weight of the residual error is bounded by this constant alpha times the original error weight plus some constant beta times the syndrome error weight. Okay, and the subscript R just means it's the stabilizer reduced weight. So we kind of discount like the possibility of adding stabilizers. You can think of it as like the distance to the code space. Okay, and the decoder that we work with is going to be this mismatch decomposition decoder by Leverrier and Zamore. But actually, this decoder is very similar to this potential based decoder that I was presenting earlier. Like we see that. It's just using this mismatch function instead of the potential function. And actually, like these two functions are defined almost the same. Right? Like we see potential function is you take the norm on the inside, and for the mismatch function, you do it on the outside. So I guess like, if you want, you can think of these as being the same decoder. So remember these like epsilon Vs were the candidate corrections that we wanted to apply for like each vertex. And so for the potential function, you just take the norm of all of these candidate corrections and you add it all together. But here, kind of you can do some canceling out of the things. But like they're essentially the same.
for this one, it's no longer local.
It's still local. You can still compute it locally because you just have to look at like the one right next to it.
What I'm giving you is like, I need to know the orders,
Sorry, which? Right. So again, like at every step, we're flipping qubits to in some local region to now like decrease the mismatch function instead of the potential. And the only difference that we need to say is that like we stop when no more flips are possible. So in the case with no measurement errors, like we always go to zero syndrome. But it's possible, like when there's some measurement errors, like it might get stuck at some point, and we just stop there when no more flips are possible. Okay, so then this algorithm, this mismatch decomposition decoder, can be run sequentially, kind of as I've described before, and it has linear runtime, similar to the potential one. But there's also a version of it that can run in parallel, because it is some like local algorithm. You just look at what corrections you need to do in some local region, and you can do all of these local corrections simultaneously. And if you do that, then Leverrier and Zamore showed that like this actually has a logarithmic running time. So you can, I guess, you can improve on the running time if you can have all of these, like if you can have this parallel setup. Okay. Right. So now we want to show that this decoder is actually single shot. And we can use a similar intuition that we had for proving why this works in the first place. And the intuition was that like we're kind of finding corrections on the boundary of the error region. And the thing is that when we have an expanding object, then it usually has a large boundary. So if you have some error region, then it will have a very large boundary. In fact, like for expander graphs, like the boundary is has size proportional to the volume. So of course, that's not something that you can do in Euclidean space. So what that means is that there's actually many places where you can make the candidate corrections. And so if you have syndrome noise, then it can only mess up like a very limited number of these possible correction locations. And there's always going to be some locations that's not affected by the syndrome noise. And you can just imagine like doing the correction in those locations in order to decrease this mismatch function. And so we do end up still shrinking this error region bit by bit until it's just dominated by the syndrome errors. And that's why the residual error could be bounded by the syndrome error itself. OK, so the main result that we show for this single-shot decoding setting is that like the sequential decoder is going to be 0 beta single shot, and the parallel decoder is going to be 2 to the minus k beta single shot. So they're both single shot decoders. And yeah, for the parallel decoder, I had this parameter k. And what I mean is that like you don't necessarily have to run the decoder until you reach, until it like absolutely gets stuck. You can just set some fixed number of iterations to run the parallel decoder for, let's say k. And then if you run it for k iterations, it's still going to be a single shot decoder. And it will just be like have these parameters 2 to the minus k beta. Okay.
Why does this condition lead to single shot decoding?
Oh, why does this condition?
Yeah, this thing.
Right. So the idea is that like e plus f hat is like e is the original error and f is the f hat is the correction. So it's saying that the residual error is going to be small. And like let's say we take this sequential decoder where alpha equals 0, then this term is always going to be 0. And it's just saying that the residual error is going to be bounded by some constant times the syndrome error.
So is it already guaranteed that I can decode the correct state? Or
So it will not get back exactly into the code space because you do have this residual error. But in general, it will just it will be some constant times the syndrome error. And that's actually the best that you can hope for, because like the syndrome error could always mess up certain like possible corrections that you can do.
But if I think about coded protocol, for instance, then because there are redundant syndrome operators, so I can try to correct the syndrome errors first, like measurement errors first, by looking at the syndrome measurement. We should be able to reduce the syndrome measurement errors quite a bit, right?
Right, but in general, like
how far we can go with that.
I think you'll never be able to correct a zero error, because like you can imagine some trivial case where, let's say, some error occurs and all of the syndromes around that error just get corrupted. Right? Then,
yes, yes, then. Yes. So that one remains, and in that case, beta will be quite small, I guess.
Beta, I guess it will be the ratio between that error region and the boundary. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So clarification question. So for something that's not single shot, how does this equation change? Like, what does the condition look like?
Right. So then, if it's not single shot, beta can be like very large, I guess, because beta not necessarily constant, right? Because if you imagine like 2D toroid, like you just have one string and two defects, and now like you mess up the syndrome for these two defects, and you just end up with this error string.
But then I could like. Then I average over multiple corrections or something, and then ensure that the right entire is smaller.
Right. If you look at multiple rounds, then of course you can correct more.
Okay.
But this is saying like really you just have one round of measurements.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Good. And yeah. Now let me consider like the stochastic setting. And we can also consider multiple rounds of errors. But here, I guess when I say multiple rounds of errors, but we actually require to do the correction using only one round of syndrome data. So in particular, like we have this error E occurring, and we measure and get the syndrome for that particular round, and we feed that into the decoder and correct, and then we run this process over and over again. And let's say that there's some IID model of errors where the errors are occurring with sufficiently small probability. Then we show that the quantum information can be maintained for exponential number of rounds with high probability. And when I say maintained, I mean like after every round of error correction, like the residual error is very small. And so this is for IID errors. But we can also use the same kind of analysis to analyze like possibly correlated errors. And we can actually analyze like kind of any space or time correlated errors. As long as you have the condition that at every single time step, you don't have a high probability of having just like a very high weight error that just like messes up your code right away. Okay, and in particular, when we have this setting, then we can also analyze the case of circuit noise. So let's say you have some circuit for extracting the syndrome and some components of that circuit can fail. Then what that will result in is that you have some small correlations in the error, right? Because you know, if this component fails, maybe it propagates to like two or three different qubits, and that'll just be some correlated errors that we can handle using this framework. Okay, now let me describe like how we get constant time decoding using quantum Tanner codes. And so recall that this K iteration parallel decoder is a single shot decoder. And so in particular, we can choose K to be a large constant, and so but it's still a constant. And so during the computation, like we only need to do a constant amount of classical processing between every error correction round. And so at each step, then we'll have some residual error that's small but possibly non-zero. And so that will allow us to maintain the quantum information during the computation. And then we can also ask like what happens at the end of the computation when we want to read off the logical information. Then to do that, let's say we want to do a computational basis measurement, just measuring all of the Z logicals, then we can measure every single individual qubit in the Z basis. And that allows us to treat measurement errors as actually like an X qubit error right before the measurement. And when we do that, then we can use the, let's say, the sequential decoder in order to recover the information. And the reason for that is for the sequential decoder, we have alpha equals zero. So the residual error is not dependent on the data error. And when we treat the measurement errors as X qubit errors, we can also assume that there's no syndrome errors as well. So actually the right hand side is zero, and we end up with zero error, and then we can read off the logical information. And so kind of the point of all of this discussion is to say that then we actually achieve this constant time overhead using single shot decoding of quantum Tanner codes. Yeah.
So I'm a little bit confused. I thought like single shot was like the idea that you don't kind of like repeat it, like kind of like don't repeat the same experiment again, right? Like as previously before the single shot error correction was like just to repeat the same kind of like you.
Right. So I guess the distinction there is that like if it's not single shot, you need to let's say for Tora code, right? You repeat like D rounds and you use like all of that syndrome information to do the decoding. And let's say like between logical operations like lattice surgery, you also need to do like another D rounds in order to get that. But when you have a single shot decoder, like you can just run one round of the decoding. Yeah. And what I'm saying here, like for repeated rounds, maybe you're confused about like this section when we have multiple rounds. What that means is like you can imagine like doing one round of error correction, and then you do a logical operation, and do another round after that.
You don't make like the, for example, the parity measurement. Like you don't repeat the parity measurement multiple times. But that would be like single shot. Like do not repeat the syndrome measurement multiple times, but only once, like single shot. But what does the case iterations refer to in the single shot? Like,
oh yeah. So the iteration refers to like the classical decoding algorithm itself. So the decoding algorithm is an iterative algorithm where you take in the syndrome information and then you try to output the correction. within that algorithm, you do the k iterations, and but it still like just only uses one round of syndrome data, like as the input.
So kind of like the time for correcting the iterations for correcting your code. Like, is this the k iterations sequential, or does this refer to the
So iteration. Okay, I tried to make a distinction in the terminology. So iteration refers to like within the classical algorithm how many like parallel steps you run. And when I say rounds, I mean like how many rounds of error correction do you run, like as in the quantum process. I'm not sure if that made sense. So let me just conclude and so we show that we have a provably correct and also efficient decoder for these quantum Tanner codes, which are LDPC codes with asymptotically good parameters. And we also show that these decoders have the single shot property for both the sequential and the parallel case. And so what that buys us is that if we combine everything with the constant space overhead, then we can actually achieve quantum error correction with constant space and constant time overhead using LDPC codes, quantum Tanner codes in particular. Of course, this is like not the end of the story, because if you have a good code and a good decoder, then that allows you to implement a quantum memory. But we also want to do computation with these codes. So then a big open question is, like, how do you efficiently implement logical gates on quantum Tanner codes or other families of LDPC codes? And this is like a big open question that I think a lot of people are working on right now. Another one that's interesting is like how do we actually choose the right LDPC code to use in practice? Because like all of these results are kind of asymptotic results. So then we can say like in the finite regime, like you know you have like 1,000 qubits. What's the best code to use for that? You know, maybe we can try to decrease the constants involved in these good code constructions, or we can find alternative constructions. And one open question that's kind of a personal interest is, if we can find a general framework for analyzing these types of decoders. As far as I know, like all of the provably correct decoders for LDPC codes are kind of these local greedy algorithms. And so they all behave similarly. They all have the same intuition for why they work. But then the proofs for these decoders are all quite different. And so it'll be nice to have some general framework to analyzing these decoders so that, you know, if we come up with a new code, then we don't spend a lot of time like coming up, you know, proving the decoder for that code. And yeah, I want to just end by mentioning again that, you know, right now, like surface code is the leading candidate for doing quantum error correction. But it would be a bit disappointing if after 25 years of research, like the best that we can do is just optimize the surface code. And so, you know, right now we have a great opportunity for making a case for using quantum LDPC codes to achieve better overhead. And like classical LDPC codes are used like everywhere. And so I think with some more work, the same can also be true for quantum LDPC codes. Okay, thanks for listening.
That's a great talk. Any questions?
So the Tanner graphs you construct, the family of Tanner graphs, like these are all planar? Like
no, they're like the quantum Tanner codes themselves, like they cannot be embedded in any like Euclidean space with like local interaction. Yeah, so I said it was like a geometric object, but that's kind of more in the maybe in the algebraic topology sense, like
yeah, like what I call like hyperbolic, kind of like
yeah, maybe it can be embedded in some hyperbolic space because you really need this property that kind of like the boundary is like proportional to the volume, so. Maybe in hyperbolic space you can implement something like that.
You said the expanding property is really essential to your decoder. So I was wondering if you could just talk a bit more about what the expanding property is. Maybe it was an implementation I didn't understand. The expanding.
Yeah. So expanding property. So I guess there's a few different notions of expansion, like graph expansion. There's you know, spectral expansion, or you can just compare like the size of the boundary of some region with the size of the region itself. Now, I guess when I say like this quantum Tanner code is expanding, or the complex for the quantum Tanner code is expanding, it's a bit hand wavy, because like if you look at the complex itself, I think it like doesn't actually qualify as a high dimensional expander. But there are certain elements of this. I think you can obtain certain graphs from this left-right KLA complex, and those would actually be expander graphs. And those are actually like those features are actually used in the proofs of like both the distance and for the decoder. So yeah, it's a bit of a vague notion just to say that, you know, this complex is expanding, but it certainly has some ingredients. Of that.
What exactly is going from that image to the second one? Like, how are you generating that?
So I guess here it will be like one square of the complex, right? We have vertices, edges, and square. And for this one, like there will be many vertices. Like all of these black vertices are, let's say, like vz, and the white vertices are vx. And then we can say that, like, you know, if we go along here, right, that would be like a square of the complex.
Okay.
And then you can have like more squares. Like there, I guess here there will be like 9 different squares. Yeah, so I just tried to draw like what happened in some local region in this complex, but because it can't really be embedded in Euclidean space, then it's a bit hard to illustrate.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Any other
questions?
Hi. So, can you think more about like how to make the arbitrary code into a one-shot code?
Oh, the result by Campbell. Yeah. So you need to take like. So you have some generating set for the stabilizers, which is what you normally would measure, but like you don't measure exactly that set. Like you might measure like a product of certain stabilizers. Like if you have like S1, you might measure like S1, S2, S5 as one of your new generators.
I see.
So you end up with this new generating set that is more like robust to measurement errors.
Can I think about it as another layer of classical code? About the threaders.
Yeah, certainly you can. And there's some work done on this, like even like data syndrome code, where you like consider the measurement and the code itself as part of just one bigger code. Certainly one can think of it like that. Yeah.
Can I design a classical LTPC code above the quantum code to make it still LTPC?
Unfortunately, like it's. LDP is not exactly the LDPC property of the classical code that you want, like because you really want to take a constant number of like original stabilizer generators in the new set, but that's not the required property to make the classical code on top of it like correcting for the errors for the syndrome errors. You need like.
Oh, maybe a dual code of the classical LDPC code.
Yeah, it's like a. So it's like a, but the dual of a LDPC code is not an LDPC code, because right? You have like a bunch of high weight, like all the code words should be high weight, essentially, and which would mean that the stabilizers are high weight. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, any question? No, that's fantastic. Okay.